This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Think about what happens when someone has a traumatic health condition. The condition is stabilized, treated, and then the patient goes through rehab. It's the same from car crashes to strokes. But what about rehab for cancer patients?
So this idea of telling cancer survivors to accept a new normal before they've had cancer rehabilitation really doesn't make sense at all.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk about the growing field of cancer rehab.
We'll also talk about how many U.S. horses that were given drugs that are dangerous for humans are winding up in the European food supply. And we'll hear how the new farm bill is making it tough for some organic farmers. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. There are millions of cancer survivors in the world, and most of them would tell you that cancer changes everything. We've often heard that the cure for cancer can sometimes be worse than the disease itself. But what happens after that cure? There's a good chance that most of these patients have not been given a referral for cancer rehabilitation and have been told to accept a new normal. Here to talk about the growing field of cancer rehab is Dr. Julie Silver, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and founder of Oncology Rehab Partners. We spoke recently about cancer rehabilitation.
Well, in cancer, it's so interesting because many survivors have been told to just accept a new normal and try to figure out how to heal on their own. And in other types of rehabilitation, such as stroke, people are not told that. Certainly, they may at some point have to accept a new normal or a different level of function, but they certainly are not told that right after they have a stroke or right after a car accident or whatever. Instead, they're offered rehabilitation. So this idea of telling cancer survivors to accept a new normal before they've had cancer rehabilitation really doesn't make sense at all.
There is so much going into a cancer patient's health after they have been a patient. Are you rehabbing the actual cancer, or are you rehabbing what they went through to cure the cancer?
One of the things that I really focus in my work on is this idea of impairment-driven cancer rehabilitation. And what that means is that we think that general exercise and diet advice is great, and the research really shows that it helps support healing and so on. But when we don't address specific impairments like pain, problems lifting your arm overhead, weakness, paralysis, difficulty swallowing, all of those types of things, then people don't heal very well. So we really want to focus in cancer rehabilitation on specific impairments, and we want to get the patients to people who know how to treat them, like physiatrists, doctors who specialize in physical medicine and rehabilitation like I do, physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech-language pathologists.
You also talk about mental health rehabilitation, and this is something that cancer patients also have to be concerned with.
A very interesting new thing that we're finding in research on distress in cancer survivors is that the number one reason for distress is physical disability. The cancer survivors are very distressed about their physical problems and the fact that they can't function at the level that they want to function at. So we really want to understand this relationship between physical and emotional health, and that it's bidirectional. One really impacts the other. And when you improve physical health, you actually improve emotional health and vice versa.
This certainly is a field where one size does not fit all. Is there a certain person that a patient could go to kind of triage what kind of rehabilitation they need?
My work has really focused in developing the STAR program, which is a cancer rehabilitation service line. And as one oncologist said, you know, I just love this, show me the front door. And that's what patients are looking for, too. They want a front door. They want to know, what number can I call? What email can I send a message to really get into these services, to really obtain these services or get access to them? And so we focus with our hospitals and cancer centers that are STAR program certified on having that front door and making sure that there is one phone number, one email contact that patients can get access to these services.
We have spoken about the STAR program. Let's get into that. Just what is the STAR program and where is it being offered?
The STAR program really stands for Survivorship Training and Rehabilitation, and it's a program that's offered at cancer centers and hospitals throughout the United States. In fact, most states, nearly all states, have STAR programs in them, and people can find out more information about where these are at the website oncologyrehabpartners.com. The STAR program really is a cancer rehabilitation service line, which means that it's an entry point for survivors who need rehabilitation care, and it involves a multidisciplinary team of trained healthcare professionals who are able to treat survivors for their rehabilitation problems.
Are there certain types of cancers where you know you're going to do better for a patient than others?
Cancer is certainly not a single diagnosis. Breast cancer is very different than prostate cancer, which is very different than lung cancer, and the treatments are very different. However, in most cancers, the treatments are fairly toxic, and people do develop impairments from the treatments themselves and also sometimes from the cancer.
Can you do something before treatment that might just mitigate the amount of rehabilitation you're going to need after treatment?
We've really been focusing on getting patients as ready as possible for upcoming treatments through prehabilitation, which means that they've been diagnosed with cancer, but they haven't yet started their acute cancer treatments. They haven't yet had surgery or started chemotherapy or whatever. And so in STAR program prehab, we're really looking at those physical and psychological interventions that will help them as they go into the storm. I really think of it sort of metaphorically as offering them an umbrella for some protection before the storm.
Is this something that your insurance company is going to even look at?
Insurance companies cover cancer rehabilitation the same way they cover other types of rehabilitation like stroke. So the good news is that your insurance almost certainly will cover cancer rehabilitation.
I'm sure there's no quick, easy answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How long does this take? How long does a patient have to go through rehab after cancer treatment?
The amount of time it takes to really try to help heal the impairments that are caused by treatments can vary. It could be a single visit with a physical therapist or occupational therapist, or it could be multiple visits. Also, many survivors will get different types of treatment over time. And so they may develop different impairments over time as well, which means that they don't necessarily just get 6 physical therapy visits and they're done forever. They may actually need more treatment later, which is why the STAR program really helps with identifying the impairments and then following the people over time and addressing them as they need to be.
A term we've heard a lot the past couple of years is chemo brain. Is this something that can also be rehabbed?
Chemo brain is a really great reason to refer survivors for cancer rehabilitation. The medical term for chemo brain is mild cognitive impairment. And if you think about this in terms of, let's say, football players who get concussions or soldiers who have head injuries and, you know, at war, blast injuries and so on, the kinds of problems that they have with memory and concentration and attention and so on are the same kinds of problems that we see with chemo brain. And these are fairly straightforward rehabilitation interventions, including consultations with occupational therapists and speech-language pathologists who can really help with the kinds of problems that these people are suffering from.
I read, too, where head and neck cancers have a particular problem for people with swallowing after treatment, and that there is a program, again, a prehabilitation program to start exercises and really relearning how to swallow.
In the prehabilitation part, the goal would be, because they haven't even started treatment in a head and neck cancer survivor, the goal would be to really strengthen those muscles before you're even starting treatment. And then on the rehabilitation side, after you've started treatment or after treatment has finished, you want to really focus on improving the strength again and better swallowing techniques. One of the things in head and neck cancer survivors that's important is that subtle impairments, subtle swallowing problems may become a big deal. For example, if someone has some subtle swallowing problems, he may feel uncomfortable going back to work. He may need extra time when he's eating lunch. He may not want to eat in front of other people where he might be at risk of choking or coughing a lot while he's eating, and that might be embarrassing and literally keep someone from going back to work. So we want to identify not only really big problems, big impairments, but also subtle ones that can significantly impact people's ability to function, including returning to work and so on.
Well, let's take a look ahead. I'm sure you're thinking of this program expanding and these types of services getting more available to people. Do you see that happening in the near future?
Cancer rehabilitation is really the new standard of care, which means that it's here to stay and that survivors should be asking their oncologists, where is it? How can I find it? Please refer me.
Dr. Julie Silver is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and founder of Oncology Rehab Partners. She's also the author of You Can Heal Yourself, published by St. Martin's Press.
Still to come, horse meat is not something many Americans even think about. But around the world, that's a different story. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1304.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Every year, over 100,000 American horses are eaten abroad. We stopped slaughtering horses in this country 5 years ago, but since then, we export live horses to slaughterhouses in Mexico and Canada. From there, most of the meat goes to the European Union. But many American horses are given drugs, drugs that people shouldn't consume. In a story from Harvest Public Media and Latitude News, Jack Rodolico reports.
New York native Kenter Penning fell in love with horse racing as a child, but it wasn't until he moved to Kentucky that he got involved with the sport. Terpenning knows what makes a winning horse.
Silky Shark was everything you want in a racehorse. He was vibrant, fiery, a very happy horse. And then on the racetrack, he earned over $100,000 career-wise.
Official winner of the ninth race, number one, Silky Shark.
Silky Shark was an athlete, but he had some medical problems. Under Terpenning's care, the horse was given a drug called phenylbutazone, or bute. It's an anti-inflammatory drug used so commonly it's referred to as horse aspirin. But bute is also a human carcinogen, so dangerous authorities in the U.S., Canada, and the European Union agree. Humans should never eat a horse given bute.
Silky Shark ended up going to a feedlot operator, a meat dealer.
Meet Seneca Crossland, executive director of the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. Her organization tracked Silky Shark's records. Despite his drug history, the horse was slaughtered and his meat got past the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. The CFIA refused to comment on this story. Here again is Kenter Penning.
Oh, I was totally devastated. Cried for probably 2 or 3 days.
Silky Shark's story shines a light on an industry operating in the shadows. When Terpenning couldn't afford to care for Silky Shark anymore, he sold the horse to a man he trusted. But then the horse was resold multiple times, winding up on what's called the slaughter pipeline. In 2011, the year Silky Shark was slaughtered, this happened to about 140,000 American horses. Not all of them were racehorses either. And it's reasonable to assume many of them would have been given drugs at some point.
Horses have not been raised as livestock. They have been raised often as companion animals. They're given drugs when they need them. People aren't holding back.
But who eats horse meat anyway? Belgium, France, and Italy, for starters. The European Union is the primary market for American horses slaughtered in Canada.
I fear that this horse represents a larger problem.
Dan Jorgensen is a member of the European Parliament. He's right. In 2010, a Tufts University study tracked 18 American racehorses that were all dosed with bute, all sent to slaughter. And just a few months ago, Belgian inspectors found the same drug in horse meat imported from Canada.
Well, I think it's quite concerning that European consumers might actually be buying and, well, eating horse meat that we don't really have any reason to believe is healthy.
Things are different in the European Union. Over there, every horse has a passport. It's a physical document recording the horse's drug history. But the EU has had a tough time enforcing those standards outside of its borders. Jorgensen says that has to change.
This is just a question of the European Union wanting to really do this. If we really want to put pressure on Mexico and Canada and the different individual companies that are actually doing this trade, we can.
Pressure on Canada and Mexico will mean change in the US. We don't track the drug history of horses in this country, which means virtually none of our horses pass the EU sniff test. Plus, the US doesn't even have jurisdiction on drug residue because we aren't slaughtering the horses. So, should we reopen horse slaughterhouses in the United States?
I don't know. I don't want to get into that can of worms.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Grandin worries if the EU cracks down, the US will be left with hundreds of thousands of unwanted horses. And most Americans don't want any horse to be slaughtered, period.
Well, I don't know what we're going to do. We've got to do something. You know, and if they don't want to have slaughter facilities, then they're going to need to have a lot of rescue places because there's going to be a bunch of horses starving out there.
So the U.S. is left with a problem. And horse lovers, the people who could petition the federal government for change, are split right down the middle on how to fix that problem. Until something changes, every week, a couple thousand American horses will be slaughtered in Canada and Mexico. Horses like Silky Shark. Ken Terpenning, back in Lexington, Kentucky, hopes someone in the U.S. creates a database to log every drug given to every American horse.
I just wish it was done. You know, I look at his pictures on my wall every day, and I just still can't believe it.
For Harvest Public Media and Latitude News, I'm Jack Rodolico.
Jack Rodolico is a reporter for Latitude News, a website that localizes the global. This story comes to us with support from the Public Radio Exchange and the Open Society Foundations.
Okay, let's assume that horse meat's not exactly your first choice for dinner tonight. Is healthy organic food more to your liking? Well, it may get a little harder to find affordable organic products in the coming months. That's because when Congress enacted new Farm Bill legislation on January 1st, it cut virtually all the funding for organic agriculture programs while retaining billions in subsidies that largely benefit conventional farms. As Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson reports, that's not sitting well with organic farmers.
Not far from the banks of the Missouri River, farmer Liz Graznick shakes organic grain into stainless steel metal bins. Her 5 dozen chickens come running through melted snow for the feed. These chickens have been certified organic by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the past 4 years, as have the vegetables grown here on Happy Hollow Farm in Jamestown, Missouri. But this year, Graznick says she may not be able to afford the fee she has to pay to get certified as organic.
My certification costs on an annual basis are close to $800. That would be really foolish of me to pay that and not get any cost share money back.
When she says cost share money, Graznick's talking about a USDA program that reimbursed farmers for some of their certification costs. It was an organic farm subsidy that, up until January, was funded by the Farm Bill. Congress couldn't come to an agreement on a new farm bill, so, as a stopgap measure, lawmakers extended parts of the bill that expired in September. The $22 million organic certification cost share program was one of many Congress chose to cut, but killing that subsidy will have a major impact. Last year, more than 9,300 certified organic operations took advantage of cost share funding. Now, Graznick and those other farmers will have to pay out of pocket if they want to continue to sell with the USDA organic seal.
It is important, but it's also $800, where I'm not making any money. It's really hard.
What would you be, say, spending that money on instead?
Electric bills. My mortgage payment for a month.
Without cost share, Graznick says she may not recertify her farm organic this year, even though she'll use the same organic practices. She doesn't think she'll lose her regular customers who buy directly from the farm or at the local farmer's market. But without the organic seal, Graznick does worry about losing future customers, and that could definitely hurt her bottom line. The cost share program wasn't the only organic program that didn't get its funding extended. Lawmakers cut $20 million worth of annual organic agriculture research and a $5 million program for organic data collection. With Washington's recent focus on belt tightening, it's no surprise that lawmakers cut farm bill programs. But after cutting virtually all the support for organic farmers, Congress didn't touch crop insurance or the direct payment program that pays $5 billion annually to farms that grow major commodity crops. Only a small percentage of organic farms qualify for these subsidies. Organic vegetable grower Dan Kibler says that makes him feel unfairly targeted.
It's like, why aren't we all just created equal? You know, that's what America's about. And so let's just do that, you know, in our policy. I don't want to have a battle with the big growers. You know, I don't want to deny them what they need. But I just want it to be fair.
There are more than 17,000 certified organic operations in the U.S., up from 7,000 a decade ago. With the number of total farmers declining nationwide, the growing organic sector represents a bright spot for rural America. Again, here's farmer Dan Kibler.
They hire people. They're purchasing things. They're making a living at it. And there's a big opportunity to revive and revitalize rural economies.
Cutting organic programs from the farm bill won't mean organic food disappears from grocery stores and farmers' markets. And there's no guarantee that these subsidies won't come back once lawmakers hammer out long-term agriculture policy, which they'll try to do in the coming months. But for now, at least, the cuts will make it harder for organic farms to stay in business. Rick Bowler has run an organic grain and cattle farm in Lebanon, Kansas, for about 20 years. He says even experienced organic farmers count on farm bill funds.
We're dependent on whether we can get enough income from the farm and if there's any help or not, and how good the insurance levels are and everything else, just like conventional people are.
Without farm bill support, organic farmers have an even tougher row to hoe, and so do shoppers looking to buy organic food. Abby Fencher-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.